Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me and organizing this workshop. So I'd like to talk to you about representing transformations. This is work that's some of it's on the archive, some of it's in progress, some of it's horrendously incomplete, and it's joint work with a few people. So Piers Lilystone, Amar Melius, Joe Emerson, Jacob Payashayan, and Stephen Bartlett. And there go. Okay, just a brief review. As you all know the kind of operational theory, I could probably just skip this, but anyway, just seeing as it takes a few seconds. An operational theory has three categories of objects. Also, feel free to interrupt me at any point if you have questions. This is either going to be quite interactive, especially at one point, or else quite short. So I don't mind either option, to be honest. So we have preparations, transformations, and measurements, and an operational theory is just a way of assigning probabilities to outcomes given that you do an experiment. So an experiment is a preparation, a transformation, or sequence thereof, and measurements. And in quantum theory, of course, preparations are pure states or mixed states, transformations are unitaries, and measurements are projectors or POVM elements or something along those lines. And the probability assignment is the Born rule. So an operation, and what is an ontological model? There's been some discussion yesterday with Marcus's talk about realism. Just as a, from the outset, I'm a committed realist. I don't necessarily know what that means, but I think there is something really out there, which obviously I think I'm real too, so it can include me. I'm happy with that, but there's something real. And an operational theory, to me, should only match observations insofar as they actually describe physics. To me, they shouldn't just be computable, compressible descriptions of things you've observed, although, you know, naturally that will be the first pass that you will actually get if you try and formulate a theory, but they should actually be something real, or some laws of nature, or something along those lines. And an ontological model of an operational theory is just a set of ontic states and conditional probability measures that have the right normalizations. So probability of having a system is one, probability of observing an outcome is one, and the operational theory is reproduced if you get the essentially the inner product between the probability measures giving the quantum, giving the operational statistics. And one of the things about ontological models is that every single operational theory has one. You can describe any operational theory whatsoever with an analog of the Beltrametti-Bygotsky, or kind of psiontic interpretation that always holds for any operational theory whatsoever. So the actual framework is without loss of generality. However, whenever you make a without loss of generality statement, if you get something in that without loss of generality that has strange properties, maybe it's because the properties conflict. So what about frame representations? There's another way of modeling operational theories. So this is generally talked about in terms of quasi-probability representations like the Wigner function, but just pointing out that actually nothing in the math requires that at all. So if you have some vector space with an inner product and you have two frames, which a frame is a generalization of a basis that allows you to have linearly dependent spanning sets, or potentially linearly dependent spanning sets. So two frames are dual frames if they allow this reconstruction formula everywhere in the operators for everything in the vector space. I'm assuming the vector space is finite dimensional because, well, I don't care about the infinite dimensional case at the moment, or in general really, but anyway. So then by linearity, you just have that the inner product between any two things in your vector space and your dual space, strictly speaking, I should actually say these are elements of dual space, is just given by an inner product essentially on the space of functions.
So what exactly did you mean when you were contrasting this with quasi-probability representations?
So generally, when you talk about a quasi-probability representation, these frames are sets of operators. And you know, if you look at the paper I'm actually citing, they talk about them as in terms of operators. And they talk about them as being linearly dependent or spanning sets for the operator space acting on, let's say, all matrices, D by D matrices. But there's actually nothing that really requires that in the actual definitions. So you can just as easily talk about them being vectors or a subspace of the space of matrices, all of these.
There are vectors in the vector space.
They're all
operators.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The key point is that it's a vector space, not that it's an operator space.
Yep. Maybe it's a silly question, but what's a frame?
That's a set of vectors that are a spanning set for the space, and they, which is,
I see.
So if they were,
because it's not clear that whether they are linearly independent.
If they are linearly, a linearly independent frame is a basis.
Okay.
And that point is actually going to come up fairly soon. So preparing a state just corresponds to sampling a point in the phase space with quasi-probability given by this inner product distribution. And measuring a POVM just corresponds to returning an outcome with a given quasi-probability. Except that these two lines here, the sampling and returning with quasi-probabilities, these things for, you know, something like the Wigner function can be negative for even more general representations. They can even be complex valued. And so it's not really a stochastic algorithm as such. And it's not at all an ontological model.
Does it mean something formal to sample from a quasi-probability representation?
So, no. I'm saying this just as in a sort of a colloquial way. What does a, you know, if you were to take one seriously, which, if you were to think that one was real, which very few people do, and I'm not one of them, then you would say that this sampling a negative probability doesn't make any sense. Sampling a complex value distribution doesn't really make any sense. It's a calculational tool. Maybe it hides something. You can sometimes get these negative or negative probabilities can arise from improper conditioning or things along those lines. There are potential ways you could say it arises from some other valid distribution by doing something invalid, but it's really just a fiction, kind of an analogous process. So a fixed.
Just a clarification. The word quasi-probability has to be taken a little bit liberally here.
Yes.
Right? So it's not normalized to one even necessarily.
So it actually can. That is subtle. The standard definition would actually. There are a bunch of standard definitions, and it actually gets quite revisionist quite quickly. Because if there are. Even in this paper, which set out a standard framework, it doesn't necessarily set out everything that you want. In particular, this to make this distribution sum to one, you have to make the trace, you know, in terms of operators, you need to make the trace of them one. That is generally not put in as an a priori assumption. Perhaps it should be, but it's not. I would say that, well, for reasons I'll get to soon, perhaps it's good that it's not, because things are already much more restrictive than they first appeared.
So you are not going to restrict yourself to the case where, like, I don't know,
no.
The thing that play the role of the measurement sum up to the identity. So
nope.
These are really completely general.
They're just completely general. This is essentially as broad a description as you could possibly get.
It's just linear,
yeah. And, okay, so a fixed pair of dual frames gives an ontological model for the set of states with non-negative distributions and the set of POVM elements with non-negative distributions. And so an example would be the discrete Wigner function. So this was, I think, introduced by Wouters in the 80s. On that point, I just mentioned that if you don't have trace one, bad things happen to your measurements or everything's negative. So the discrete Wigner function is these four phase point operators where you have plus sign on the identity and signs on the Paulis that have parity of one. The frame has four elements and you can actually, so it is a basis, and for every basis there's a unique dual basis. And you can go, well, what's the set of non-negative states and measurements? Well, my frame operators really correspond to the vertices of the cube up to some factor. And so things will be negative if they essentially lie on the other side of the plane, perpendicular to the block vector of each phase point operator. So,
Charlie, you just said that they correspond to the vertices of the cube, but there's only four of them. Did you mean the vertices of a
subset?
Tetrahedron?
Yeah, tetrahedron, yeah. A subset of the vertices of the cube, yeah, the tetrahedron. And so you can essentially cut off four different slices and you get this funny looking shape here, which is the set of non-negative states. And because it's a qubit, every measurements and states have a very close relationship to each other.
Sorry, Joel, can you go back? I missed something. What were you varying over as you moved the red dot around?
Oh, these are essentially the block vectors of the phase point operators. So you can see, yes, they are of a tetrahedron. So this point, this point, right, this point, it's easy, just, have I actually done it the right way around? Yes. Yep.
Okay. And then, but what's going on with the yellow shape? It's also changing.
So these ones, so essentially, just geometrically, you can think of what states are represented non-negatively. Well, they're the things that have non-negative inner product with each of these phase point operators. And geometrically, that just means, I have the center of my block sphere here, so I have a vector there. And so the things that are going to be negative are going to lie in a plane normal to that vector. The things that have zero inner product, like these are half space inequalities.
Okay.
So the things that are negative are going to lie on one side of a plane perpendicular to my block vector, which is this plane here is the plane of zero inner product with that guy.
And is that plane going through the origin?
No. It's...
So the vector is being defined relative to the center.
Relative to the center, yeah.
So if I take a vector in the opposite direction and I get it longer than...
Then it has a negative inner product, yeah.
I see. And you're building up the set of guys that have positive inner product with all four vertices in a step-by-step fashion. So there's
exactly.
No fundamental significance to these shapes. It's the final shape.
It's the final shape that matters, important. Yeah.
And the final shape is just a shaped off... block sphere.
Pretty much, yeah. Cheese wedge kind of in this strange. Kind of like cheese wedge on this side or something strange. Shaved off. It's the intersection of a tetrahedron, as you know, with the sphere. So in generalized contextuality, we have that any two operational objects that generate the same statistics when varied over all other operations are ontologically identical. Some people seem to like this principle. And any preparation and measurement non-contextual model, there's a close relationship between ontological models and quasi-probability representations, considered in terms of representations over operator space, which is that any preparation and measurement non-contextual model can be obtained by restricting some quasi-probability representation to the preparations and measurements for which it's non-negative, where the slight caveat there is that the frames you use to define the quasi-probability representation may be frames of a subspace of the operator space rather than the full space. And any quasi-probability representation is a preparation and measurement non-contextual ontological model for the preparations and measurements it represents negatively, non-negatively. I always get my nons mixed around. So essentially that means if you want to study generalized non-contextuality, one of the best tools, one of the easiest tools we have to do it is using quasi-probability representations. And I've been emphasizing preparation and measurement non-contextuality. So why is that? Well, transformations are often ignored. And for better or worse, they're folded into preparations and measurements. Now, of course, you can define a quasi-probability representation of a linear map just by taking the elements of your drill frame and re-expanding them so that you get the correct evolution of your state. And you can note that this thing is really the correct definition because one way of arguing that it's the correct definition is that that's actually equivalent to a different quasi-probability representation of a related state. So if you apply the Troy-Jan-Mikulski isomorphism, I have specialized assuming this is the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, so trace AB, then I can just essentially apply this maximally entangled state trick to re-expand it as the quasi-probability representation of a maximally entangled state on a larger system. So any way of redefining a quasi-probability representation of a transformation is essentially going to be an argument that you should redefine the quasi-probability representation of a state. Now, is this a non-contextual map for non-negative transformations? The answer is yes. For preparations, the only contexts are different convex combinations. For transformations, you get some new contexts, which are that you can talk about compositions of channels. Now, convex linearity is manifestly respected, and you can also show that essentially composition is also respected, so this thing is a non-contextual model. Represents transformations non-contextually, except the relation between non-contextuality and non-negativity is that essentially non-contextuality is a property of an ontological model, not of a quasi-probability representation. So it's non-contextual for the transformations it represents non-negatively. So an initial question you might ask, a question I asked a few years ago, what things can you represent non-negatively? And when I looked at preparations and measurements, it was like, well, the space is actually fairly limited. And I represented the transformations in a particular way in this paper in 2013 on different quasi-probability representations. And I unfortunately neglected something, which I'm not the only person to do, which is completely neglected what the contextuality of the transformations. So when you initially think about it, you go, okay, I can come up with a representation of my states and my measurements, and I can just assume that my unitaries act as a permutation on my frame operators, or some of them do. And that's actually a very good insight, but it loses a lot of generality. So how should you actually represent a transformation? In particular, how should you represent the identity transformation? Well, suppose you leave a system alone for an instant, and let's make that instant really instant. How does the ontic state evolve? Well, if you're in an ontological model and you make it sufficiently short, at least a reasonable assumption is that it shouldn't evolve at all. So for the identity channel to be represented non-negatively, you need the quasi-probability representation of the identity channel to be a delta function. Now, while I made an argument here in terms of the identity transformation and doing nothing, this is actually a general point that any non-negatively represented invertible, any invertible stochastic map whose inverse, or any stochastic map whose inverse is a stochastic map, has to be a permutation matrix. And so this is actually quite a generic point that to get a non-negative representation, you need delta functions or some permutation matrix. And you can only do that if you have d squared points. You can only do that if you have a basis, not a frame. So all of the arguments about having all of the mathematical work on setting up frames and trying to distinguish between frames and bases was actually, in a sense, a little bit of a red herring. It gives a generalized quasi-probability representation, but it doesn't give anything new to study from the point of an ontological model, unless you're going to do some very crazy stuff. So one of the easiest ways around this is that whenever you're defining a quasi-probability representation, you have freedom in the map for any part of the operator space that you don't represent. So if the only thing you have is an identity transformation, then you can make it be the delta function and everything works fine. But as soon as you, but that's a very boring theory. So there's essentially no actual overcomplete frames. Give any overcomplete frame gives is either trivial dynamics or no dynamics at all. Take your pick.
Can you go over the argument for why you can only represent an identity by the identity permutation if the ontic state space has d squared points?
So let's go back here.
Is it just that I could have written that as if and only if it's a basis rather than an overcomplete basis? Is that the yes?
It has to be a basis rather than an overcomplete basis, yes.
Right. Because in an overcomplete basis, you'll never find the identity.
You'll never find a permutation, in fact, because you can't be have zero inner product with a linearly independent set of operators unless you're the zero operator. And so the only way you can have assuming you've removed zero operators from your frame, or zero vectors from your frame, which if you have zero vectors, you can't really do a delta function anyway. There's just no way you can, anything is that's orthogonal to d squared minus one points must be non-orthogonal to all remaining points. If you transform to a basis, a linearly independent. Yeah, if you transform to a basis, you've got to have overlap with at least one thing. And if you only have overlap with one thing, then it's essentially an orthogonal basis, right? Or not an orthogonal, the bi-orthogonal basis.
Sorry, just one more.
Yep. Keep going.
So the argument for which you say the identity should be represented as the identity at the ontological level, I guess is something like Rob's argument of the identity of the indiscernibles,
Well, yes and no. You can motivate it by that.
Yes.
So I'll get to that in a little bit, but I would more say that you need the identity. The identity can be applied many times to give you the identity. And so whatever it is has to be idempotent. It's a stochastic map. So the informal argument is you leave it for an infinitely short amount of time, nothing happens ontologically. But the more formal argument is that you have some kind of stochastic matrix. And any power of that stochastic matrix is itself.
But in principle, you could have many different operations at the ontological level that would lead to the identity at the operational level. So there could be the very short evolution and the longer evolution where you preserve the state.
Yeah.
So it seems that in a sense you do need that argument to make the point.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so the assumption is that every implementation of the identity is the same. And so if every implementation is the same and it's a stochastic matrix, it must be the identity.
But on the other hand, if you take that point of view from the start, somehow you know that you need a basis because otherwise you would have two equivalent quasi-probability representations at the ontological level of the same operational state. So somehow it's...
Well, yes and no, not really. I mean, yes, you do need a basis at the start, but this map here does actually give a unique map for the identity transformation. it's just negative in general.
Yeah.
If you have an overcomplete frame, it's just negative. So it's unique. It's, you know, it's a one-to-one map. It's injective. It's faithful. And you don't have to have multiple maps for the same thing. It is idempotent. It turns out the identity map here, even though it's negatively represented, is idempotent. It's just that it's negatively represented. And so that's the thing that if you're trying to, that should have been obvious, and I think is perhaps obvious, hopefully because I'm belaboring the point, but was not obvious. Many, 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 many people have constructed quasi-probability representations over the last 50 years that have more than d-squared, that have more than a basis.
Yeah, sure.
And it just turns out that all of those things represent the identity transformation negatively. If you apply the same kind of representation that you should be using. That's okay. What is the time? So as an example, so I'm just going to give two specific examples that have come up in the last few years that have both been presented as non-contextual ontological models. So the first one is this from this paper I mentioned that I did in my PhD with Stephen Bartlett, and which we recently essentially commented on, that this model is contextual. so I mentioned earlier the four-state Wigner function, where you look at the phase point operators by taking the vertices of a tetrahedron, as Rob pointed out. And as an ontological model, that is actually, on the face of it, a rather strange one. And the reason is having the signs on these Pauli operators correspond to the expectation values of Paulis. And if you were to just give me an experiment and ask me, with no structural information, and ask me, are the expectation values of X, Y, and Z dependent or independent, I would tell you, you know, for the stabilizer states, they're independent. Right? I have no dependency introduced by them. If I have an X basis eigenstate, then Y and Z are completely independent. And if I counterfactually knew one, I shouldn't expect to be able to predict the other any better. That's actually reflected by the eight state. You know, in the Wigner function, that doesn't actually have the property. If you knew the outcome of X and Y, you would know the outcome of Z. So this eight state model.
Can I make a brief comment, just as sort of an intuition that goes in the opposite direction? So I'm curious what you think about it. If X, Y, and Z really had been totally independent, you might have expected that there would exist a pancake map, a map that takes the block sphere to a pancake. Right? It leaves X and Z invariant, but it depolarizes along Y. But in fact, if X and Z are left invariant, then the map also leaves Y invariant, which suggests that Y is not independent of X and Z. So it's an intuition that goes opposite to what you just described.
So I would agree that when I was... So the situation I had in mind was if you just had observations, if you had essentially what some of my colleagues like to call a gate set with buttons, and you had very limited control, and you can prepare and measure in Pauli eigenstates and do nothing else. If that was the box that was given to you, then a natural ontological model would just be these things are independent. So the dynamics, you know, I mean, full quantum theory, X, Y, and Z have some structural relations between them. The toy theory that's described non-negatively by the Wigner function doesn't really have as much of that dynamics represented non-negatively in it.
You still don't have a pancake map, even in the toy theory. Do you still have that failure of independence? What, Y is equal to X times Z in toy theory?
In the toy theory, yes. The toy theory, but that's not derived just from the operational observations of outcomes of X given Y. Right, like to make that prediction, you need an axiom. That axiom could be the knowledge balance principle. It could be this is a quantum system. But if I just gave you, imagine I give you a box and it has three buttons, or six buttons. Prepare X, nine buttons, I can't count. Prepare plus, prepare minus, prepare zero, prepare one, prepare I, prepare minus I. And then measure in X basis, prepare in Y basis, prepare in Z basis. And I asked you to construct a model for that to predict. Based on, predict the outcome of X based on your previous button presses. What would that model look like? If that was all the operations you could do.
Okay.
I would say that to a first, this is what you'd come up with first, not the Wigner function. So the frame has eight elements, so the dual is not unique. We can just choose one. Let's make it proportional just because that makes everything nice. And now we actually get an octahedron of non-negative states. This is exactly the convex hull of the Pauli eigenstates. And the nice thing about this and the original motivation for it was that all Clifford transformations permute the frame elements because they permute the Paulis and they flip signs, and I've got all signs and all Paulis. And this gives a technically a faithful representation of the Clifford group. But it doesn't give a faithful representation of the semigroup, so it's not non-contextual under convex combinations. And the proof of this is actually really simple, which is that I have eight elements of my frame. If I start in one and I apply a random Pauli, that random Pauli will take me to one of four points. If I apply a random Clifford, it will take me to any of the eight points. These two maps both implement the depolarizing channel, and so they're operationally the same, but they're ontologically distinct. This also happens with the rebit Wigner function. So here we we look at only the operator space of real valued operators. This frame has four elements, which means it's overcomplete for this subspace, so the dual isn't unique, but again, we'll just set the frame, set it to be proportional, the frame and dual frame to be proportional. Now, if you apply an I or a Y randomly, then what that will do is it will flip. If you apply an I, you do nothing to the frame operator. If you apply a Y, you flip both X and Z. So you'll go from, say, the state with the X equals 1, Z equals 1, to the state X equals minus 1, Z equals minus 1. If you apply an X or a Z randomly, then you'll map, if you apply an X, then you'll do nothing to the value of X, little x, but you'll flip the value of little z, and vice versa. And these two are not equivalent maps on the full space, but they are equivalent on the subspace of these operators. So essentially, because you're flipping the signs, you're completely, on average, when you average them out, you annihilate the x and z components of whatever state you have. So again, these operations, they're identical on rebit states, but they're represented ontologically differently. So here's where we get to something where I've deliberately put in something that I hope will get some discussion going, because I'd like to know more about it. So we have this principle of generalized contextuality that any two operational objects that have the same operational statistics when varied over all other operations are ontologically identical. And one way that you might try and justify this is by appealing to Leibniz's principle, which is that any two distinct objects have a distinct property. Or an empiricist version thereof, that any two distinct objects can be distinguished by measuring some property. This is actually quite a fun principle because it leads to people making some very bizarre conclusions, and some of them are quite entertaining. So, for instance, if you have a perfectly symmetric universe and two perfectly symmetric spheres that are equidistant around the point of symmetry, are they the same object or not? And by Leibniz's principle, some would say they are the same object, and some would say that, no, they're of course not. It was quite entertaining, for me at least. But for me, I am not entirely convinced that generalized contextuality is actually a good appeal to Leibniz's principle. And the reason is that Leibniz's principle is a comment about the whether properties can be distinguished in principle. And I would argue that if you have operational objects that are mixed due to information loss to the environment, then you can measure the environment. These objects can be distinguished by some property. Now, a possible... Okay. So for me, applying generalized contextuality to mixed operations is more of a no fine-tuning argument than an appeal to Leibniz's principle. And Rob, what do you think of that?
maybe I'm not quite following your objection. Can you spell it out?
So Leibniz's principle is really a statement about how do you know that two objects, what does it mean for two objects to be the same, to be different, right? What it means for two objects to be different, according to Leibniz, is that they have some different property. And contextuality, to me, is generally, particularly, I guess, the mixed form, is ignoring the property that would distinguish the things. And so you have this situation where there are essentially coarse-grained distributions that don't fully represent the things that you're saying, whether they're the same or different. So you've essentially thrown away the information that would enable you to discern them.
So let me see what you say about the following example. So suppose I tell you lambda, polyontic state, by fiat,
yep,
is the only thing which acts as a causal mediary between the preparation procedure and the outcomes of some future measurement. So that's what I mean by lambda. It's the only complete causal mediary between those guys. So then the principle here says, look, if I have two preparation procedures that might differ in lots of details, but they are equivalent in the sense that they even make all the same inferences about the outcomes of future measurements, then Leibniz tells me they should be equivalent in the sense that they lead me to make all the same inferences about the causal mediary, and that's why they lead me to make all the same causal inferences about the outcomes of future measurements. Now, if somebody said, look, there is some information out there that would be pertinent this is where I'm not quite sure what you're trying to say, but like I often think of like the paint on the devices. Like, so if the preparation procedures differed by virtue of the color of the paint, that doesn't affect the statistics. And so I say it shouldn't affect the distribution of the ontic states either, because that's the only causal mediator. There's no direct influence of the color of the paint on the future statistics. It all has to go through lambda.
So my response would be that the lambda,
yeah,
is the thing to which you apply Leibniz's principle. That the individual lambdas, not the distributions on lambdas, the individual lambdas are the same, independent of whether you, they're ontologically, like what it means for it to be a lambda is that all the properties of the system are encoded in it, right?
Yeah, see, I think maybe that's where I would disagree, that it, for some cases you can only apply Leibniz. If I'm in a circumstance of incomplete information, then maybe all I have operationally is some incomplete information about what the outcomes of future experiments will be. I can't predict them perfectly. So in that situation, I don't expect to be able to make perfect inferences about the ontic state either. So Leibniz's principle, in a sense, doesn't give me warrant to make claims about, you know, identity of physical states. It's really just identity of distributions over physical states that I can...
I mean, I would say that Leibniz's principle doesn't even give you that. At least the formulations I'm aware of it are explicitly to do with ontological properties. And as soon as you know, the the distribution is not an ontological property of the system.
Okay, well then maybe you'd be happier if I'd said this is not an instance of Leibniz's principle strictly, but a generalized form of Leibniz's principle, which refers to statistical distributions.
Yeah, so I guess for me the question is that really Leibniz's principle, or is that a fine-tuning thing?
Leibniz's principle applied at a
different level to epistemic. So, you know, apologies to everyone that is not necessarily following this discussion along. I work from such a distant university from Rob that it's difficult for me to get to discuss these things with him. But this has been one of the things that has essentially been troubling me for some time. You know, the link between contextuality and Leibniz's principle, and the link between contextuality and computation. And to me, let's go kind of back to this famous quote, which is, so we have what I would say, when we talk about contextuality and its property specifically of distributions, one of the notorious problems in foundations, in fact, one of the problems that Rob set up to try and untangle, is what's epistemic and what's ontic? And to me, if you have a principle that's explicitly about an ontology, like Leibniz's principle is, it's a principle specifically as a rationalist to try and understand what does it mean for something to be real, then applying it to things that we know to be epistemic and then drawing a conclusion that then saying I'm confused is sort of asking for trouble. If you get to that stage, which we are at essentially, which is where we're at, where we have a principle that we think is based on another principle, and we have results essentially showing that nothing is ever satisfied under that principle, then maybe it's time to investigate whether that principle should be applied differently. And so one way in which I'm thinking of doing that, and I'm not necessarily happy about this, just it seems to be a way to work. So I would say that my distinction between Leibniz's principle and fine-tuning is somewhat precarious, because every operation ultimately can be distinguished from every other operation by measuring the guy who did it. If we have a universally applicable theory. But I would say that there are some things that at least ontologically you may want to argue that there's something like scale invariance for time, for instance. That you can't tell what time is. You can't tell an absolute rate of time. And so what that would imply is that there's no operational way to distinguish. So if we go back to just considering unitary transformations, if you apply two unitaries and then forget that you did them in two steps, or you apply them in the composite in one step, there's no operational way to distinguish between these two. And what I was trying to get at just then is, you might say, well, sure, I can distinguish, I can measure the guy who forgot. Now, if these things are actually time evolution of some system and there's no natural time scale, then these things are actually next to impossible to distinguish, I would say even in principle. Ontologically, they should be sort of, I think, but I don't know, that they should be the same. So the context for unitary operations just boils down to composition. And it's at least plausible that that is next to impossible to actually distinguish between different types of composition. And what that means that is if you want transformation non-contextuality just for a group of unitaries, then there's a technical name for what you want. You want a representation of your group, not of the semigroup, so it should compose as a group homomorphism. And it should also be, if it's to be non-negative, it should also be a permutation representation. Now, one thing here is that if you have just pure operations, there's this result from, there's this result from Montina and Chen in 2012, I believe, showing that the only non-measurement, non-contextual theory is the Beltrametti-Bugatsky theory, which is just a psiontic model, and that same model is also generalized non-contextual for what I would call pure operations, where pure operations just consist of pure states, unitary transformations, and projection-valued measures. Now, part of the reason that it's non-contextual for these operations is that there are very few contexts. There's no context for preparations, because I've explicitly forbidden all the contexts that could cause problems. The context for unitaries are just compositions, and we have a permutation representation. And because I don't have outcome determinism, I also don't have contextuality for measurement. So this is a generalized non-contextual theory, which means that the entire problem with contextuality is coming in from the convex combinations arguments. And whether that's indicative, whether that should be the case or not, is something that I'm still unclear about. So yeah, you can get, you can put things like standard proofs of state-independent non-contextuality, and they don't have problems here because they all assume outcome determinism, and this is not an outcome deterministic model. Now, I'm going to take a very sharp turn here, or it may seem very jarring to people, which is that a lot of this thinking has been, in my mind, influenced by, I guess you could call them applications. I think that might be a dirty word here at this conference, but even the observation of transformation non-contextuality for me actually came about when I was looking at characterizing gate-dependent noise in experiments, which ends up being quite a nightmare. So one of the other things that I'm interested in at the moment is simulating quantum systems for various reasons, and I was looking at different ways you could do it. And it turns out that actually, this was started essentially in that paper I earlier, looking at different representations of transformation groups. If you have an non-contextual ontological model, if you want to construct a simulation for elements for some finite group, then a good way to do it is to construct a non-contextual ontological model that's going to be equivalent to some permutation representation. Once you have a permutation representation, you can just associate the elements of the representation space to operators, if you want a quasi-probability representation, or pure states, which is actually generally more efficient. If you associate it to pure states, you'll get a preparation contextual representation where you use the natural action of G. Now, the nice thing about this, and part of the original motivation, was trying to understand where the contextuality in the qubit stabilizer subtheory is. And it's not transformation contextuality on the unitaries, because you get a transformation start from some generic frame operator, which is assigned some of Pauli's, and if you take the orbit of it under the n-cubic Clifford group, you get a non-contextual ontological model of the Clifford group transformations. And in this case, if you start from the ontic space is essentially the space of functions over bit strings, and if you start from the zero point and take the orbit, then the ontic space is a subset of quadratic functions. And this one is essentially, it actually ends up being roughly equivalent to Gottesman-Knill. So then, if you do this, if you try and use this as a simulation algorithm, your best case simulation cost is on the order of the log of the dimension, with some caveats for compact groups that I generally don't talk about. And you can simulate in addition. So one of the points here is that if you wanted to try and simulate a larger group, you could try and construct a frame that's represented by that has a permutation symmetry given by the larger group. That will generally explode because if you know there's very few finite subgroups. So one of the interesting insights, one of the discussions over the past few years has been that maybe contextuality is a resource for quantum computation. I actually think we should flip that on its head and say, actually, contextuality is a resource for classical simulations of quantum computations. And so what do I mean by that? We can simulate an additional unitary relative to some frame that has a permutation representation for another group by finding some map that allows us to reconstruct our frame operators. Now this could in principle be horrendously inefficient, it's generally not too bad. Then we can add some initial additional variable, which I'm going to initialize to one. And then whenever we hit that gate in a circuit, we can map and we can evolve our phase space operator to some new point in phase space according to a probability distribution. And this probability distribution can actually be completely arbitrary. And map kappa to be the quasi-probability representation for that transition from lambda to lambda prime divided by the probability. And a natural probability is given by essentially normal, taking the absolute value of our expansion coefficients and normalizing. And this in this paper, we were specifically concerned with operator representations of operators, but everything works perfectly naturally for more generic objects, you know, such as pure states. So we can write all stabilizer states in terms of phases, a linear superposition of bit strings with phases given over an affine subspace with phases given by a linear and a quadratic function. So let's just take our ontic state space to be a set of affine spaces, linear functions, and quadratic functions, and applying a Clifford gate just permutes these tuples around. And let's say we want to add some other gate. Well, we know that essentially, you know, you're not going to be able to add another gate because in a non-contextual way, because if you were, you would have a dense subgroup, which essentially, and you can't have a permutation representation of a dense subgroup on a finite space in this way. Not a faithful one anyway. But so we can make use of that to, seeing as we know it's going to be contextual anyway, let's just exploit that to try and get the best, the most efficient simulations possible. So if I look at, say, cos theta I plus I sine theta times some Pauli, you can implement that by applying identity or P or the Pauli with probabilities. This is essentially the natural probability distribution from the previous screen. And sometimes, of course, you find that you don't actually need to apply any gate at all because the stabilizer state that your lambda is invariant under this gate. And you would need on an order of 2 to the m samples to converge to a reasonable estimate for m gates for pion 8, which is the one of the best gates for achieving universality. Alternatively, you can just use another decomposition, which is applying identity and identity plus I times p over square root 2, which is another Clifford gate. And this one converges a lot faster. So you're going from 2 to the m for m gates to 1.17 to the m. This is pretty neat saving. And this is actually a very, very general observation. So if you take a bunch of gates from different sets, then you can find, if you want to simulate Clifford gates with MT gates, you get a scaling of 2 to the 0.23m, which is 1.17 to the... This was from my student who uses a slightly different normalization convention, but it's 1.17 is 2 to the 0.23. If you want to do cyclotomic Cliffords, then you find you need even less samples. If you want to do nth roots of Hadamards, again, 2 to the 0.46. This is one of the harder ones to implement. And you can then quantify different gates essentially by how much they take. The resource here is essentially looking at how contextual these gates is not looking at whether they're contextual, because they're all contextual. It's looking at a specific property of how much can you use that contextuality to short-circuit your simulation. And that was really just using the fact that you can decompose things in terms of sums of operators, but we know that and that's what simulation algorithms generally exploit. But if we have compositions, if we're going down this path of trying to use contextuality, we should use compositions as well. So if I have, how can I use that? Well, here's a trivial example. If I have two copies of a magic gate, then I can just compress them, and that's usually easier to compute. If I have some Clifford in between them, then I can still do the same thing. I just am composing two slightly different gates. Now, what's interesting here is I can... Why did I put that in? That's a leftover note. So one thing that I can do when I'm trying to simulate a circuit is I can move all the non-Clifford gates to the end of the circuit. And while the non-Clifford gates become entangling, the point here is if they're initially sparse in the Clifford frame or the Pauli frame, they remain sparse at the end of the circuit. And then the question for the optimal simulation is, given a set of sparse non-Clifford gates, find a sparser representation of the composite. This should be sound somewhat familiar, because an analogous thing for states is done, has been investigated recently by Bravi, Gose, and Smolin. And I forgot to put the citation up. My apologies. So let's suppose, how can we actually exploit this? Let's suppose the magic gates are the exponentials of Paulis for some Pauli. Then when I move at the last magic gate to the end of the circuit, it remains an exponential of some different Pauli. And so I can essentially iterate and move them all, and then I just have a product of exponentials of Paulis. And these are all sparse now. So ideally, we'd want to minimize the L1 norm of the decomposition of the product of these gates. That's hard. So yeah, we'll do a slightly different thing first, which is we'll minimize the L0 norm. And even just to show that you can get some advantage, we just want to show that you can make the L0 norm of this guy less than 2 to the m. And this corresponds to sampling from a suboptimal probability distribution at each point, essentially a delta function, so uniformly over the things that have non-zero weight. And to essentially get some advantage, it's sufficient to make the L0 naught to make a product of two of these exponentials have a decomposition with less than 4 terms, and that's really easy. I can do that. If P0 and P1 commute without loss of generality, then you have a ZI and an IZ, unless one of them's the identity, in which case it's even easier. And that has a decomposition in terms of 3 gates. Essentially, the CZ, if you look at it, as a -1 down here. If I conjugate it by an X, I move the -1 to here. And the product of these two gates has essentially this form. Where I may have gotten the signs wrong. There we go. And so that thing can be decomposed just in terms of an identity in two ZZ gates. If my Pauli's anti-commute, then I can make use of, then I can again get three terms. So I have an identity, a P0 and P1, just expanding the product out and gathering the terms that have P0 times the identity and P1 times the identity here. I have one Clifford, two Cliffords, and it turns out that this guy is always a Clifford too. The sum of two anti-commuting Pauli's is always proportional to a Clifford gate. So just as a conclusion, I'd like to say that transformations are often overlooked, and they shouldn't be. There's a lot of fascinating, quite rich structure to them. And they actually allow us to say that there are fewer non-contextual models than we thought, at least if you want those non-contextual models to have any kind of non-trivial dynamics. And one of the buzz, the little cottage industries, has been showing that contextuality is a resource for doing quantum things over classical, but I'd actually say that in some ways, contextuality enables you to simulate quantum things in a classical way much better than you would have done naively. And so that's kind of an open problem, fully working out how, fully investigating how that relates. It makes the question of how do you relate a resource to contextuality or any fundamental property a lot more complicated than we might have thought. Okay, thank you.
On your third point, the work from Anders and Brown, Rosendorf, was surprising to me because it was contextuality helping promote a weak classical computer to a stronger classical computer. Is there any relationship between that and what you're describing here?
I hadn't thought about that. I mean, that's always been kind of in the back of my mind, that the promotion there is somehow strange. It's a combination of an operational restriction, right? Like, you're restricting by a locality in an interesting way. Whereas, yeah, okay. I mean, in for that kind of work, for those kinds of results, what I'm saying doesn't quite mesh properly, because contextuality in a classical simulation would be non-locality. So if you have the resource to send a superluminal message, then you can do better. In those scenarios, right? Like, so the idea in those not familiar if you're with Anderson Brown's paper, they showed that the GHZ state can be used to enable a linear control computer to compute a nonlinear function, which is impossible otherwise. Actually, I was going down the wrong track now that I spell it out more. I guess you would need to look at the restrictions on the control computer.
It's not really a non-locality proof because it's really GHZ in the surface of a contextuality proof because you have feed forward.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess in that sense, contextuality and computational resources haven't been, in the classical realm, haven't been related that closely. What would it mean if the contextuality in your model is of the form that it has some, is hard to compute, then it's an advantage. So I mentioned, in this last in the simulation algorithm, I mentioned at one point that maybe finding the map is hard. Finding the contextual map. If you're given, essentially, I think part of the computational complexity, if you were to try and phrase things in an all or nothing sense, part of the computational complexity could easily be smuggled into that, finding a contextual map.
Second point, in particular, you don't mean there are less scenarios which admit of a non-contextual model than we thought. You mean for a non-contextual scenario, there are less distinct ontological models which are non-contextual.
We thought we had a family of non-contextual models. Most of them are contextual. When you actually consider transformations, they end up being contextual. So I had this list in my paper, in my PRA on quasi-probability representations, where I had a bunch of different groups that I said, here's a non-contextual model for. Some of those have kind of been cropped up independently over the years, both before and after. And of those, two of about six are non-contextual. If you look at a generic table of quasi-probability representations, the standard statement would have been, take the restriction of these to the non-negative stuff, and that's a non-contextual ontological model. For most of them, that's false, because for most of them, they actually have overcomplete frames. So they do things like doubling the phase space to account for qubits. Or
so you're talking about the subtheories of a qubit?
Yeah.
Which were deemed non-contextual, and you're saying if you include...
Most of them are actually contextual.
Okay. Really is that there are less scenarios which admit of a non-contextual model than was previously found.
Yeah.
So, out of curiosity, what did you think? In my talk, I suggested that maybe if we try to implement a cut-motile version of these Clifford subtheories, we realize that the things we would need to do experimental tests of contextuality actually requires to go outside of the Clifford formalism, in which case we could say, if you're only interested in cut-motile theories, then all this Clifford subtheory stuff is perhaps non-contextual, because all these counterexamples we have might require non-Clifford resources. So I'm just curious what you think about that.
I'm not sure. So one of the interesting things that I found, well, one of the things I actually found intriguing about your talk was the suggestion that cut motility may, in fact, rule out mixed operations. And that seems to be something,
certain kinds of
mixed operations.
Right.
That seems to be a theme I'm bumping into here that is coming about because of dynamics. Like wanting to have dynamics represented non-contextually. So that makes me wonder if there's a relation between cut motility and non-contextuality of dynamics, which seems plausible, because cut motility is all about giving a dynamic origin. As to whether I think that the cut motility of, or the immotility of the Cliffords is an explanation for why you can't simulate them. I don't know. So if you have a cut motile theory, yeah, Okay, so you can never do basis changes. Which really suggests, yeah, I mean, quite probably there's a relation, but I don't know.
Maybe an interesting question in the sphere, something like, if I imagine a foil theory world that's cut motile,
yeah.
Clifford theory the way I wanted to define it,
defining
do I even have the resources to ask questions about classical simulatability? There will be, unlike a quantum world which contains classical probability theory within it as a special case, a Clifford sub-theory world does not contain all of classical probability theory within it. For example, I can't generate arbitrary probability distributions. Right? It's just not there.
You also have restricted computational power.
Sorry?
You also have restricted computational power even relative to classical computers.
True, but we could have still asked something like, you know, we're not going to have a universal classical computer in that world, but we will have like a linear classical computation probably.
Well, yeah, you can do that using the theory, right?
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe the goalpost changes a little bit and it becomes a different kind of question, but I wonder if maybe the very question that computer scientists focus on, which is classical simulatability, might not even be well posed in some of these foil theories. Like, if I'm imagining a world where there is no possibility of building a classical computer to simulate something else, it kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If you're taking it seriously as a foil theory, you should not provide a universal classical computer.
Maybe the more interesting question would just be, what's the computational, what kinds of computations could you do in that world? How do they compare to the kinds of computations you could do in a classical world? Something like that.
I mean, just linear, right? Hmm? It should just be linear. I don't think you can do anything other than linear computations.
Sure, if we're talking about the Clifford case.
Yeah, for the Clifford case.
But I guess the conjecture would then be that something like, take a landscape of foil theories, different worlds, all of those that admit of non-contextual models are computationally
trivial
in some sense, and it is a necessary condition for being computationally interesting that you fail to admit of a non-contextual model. So we would have that sort of tight connection between contextuality and computational power for the subsets of cut motile theories.
So I'm trying to think if there's any kind of, because there are so few sub-theories, it's almost a proof by exhaustion. Like, you basically have the qubit stabilizers, the Q-dit stabilizer sub-theories, the match gates, and do we know of anything else that's finite? Classical computation, I guess.
But we could talk about more foil theories than those that can be embedded in quantum theory, so we could go to more radical kinds of alternatives.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you actually know of any really radical ones besides the classical computer can be embedded? Is that cut motile? That should be. It almost has to be.
In some sense, I think it is a rich landscape if you don't apply many principles, because like, if I take the Oxford perspective where you have a category of processes, they needn't be stochastic maps, they needn't be CP maps, they're just some category of processes, and I can talk about subcategories of processes within that. I can imagine a lot of formally cut motile things, you know, so I can sort of build a bunch of stuff. They might not be in any sense empirical competitors to quantum theory. They might be a lot further from reality than toy theories are. But I could build them, and I could just ask a question like,
is any
if the computational power of those worlds linked to the existence existence or not of an architectural model of those things.
So,
why can't you generate arbitrary probability distributions of powers that have built up approximation data distributions?
So Julie and I were talking about this at the coffee break. So, if, say I have a Clifford subtheory, I could certainly implement any number of coin flips that are all uniformly biased. So suppose I do that by preparing plus states and then, you know, measuring in 0-1 basis. The problem is that now, if I want to generate some rational probability, I can say, right, all the n-bit strings have to be now partitioned into, say, the strings that run from all zeros to some particular sequence, and then all the rest, right? So I could let's say I have 2 to the n, and I want to give you some particular rational number, then I have to partition them. So now I need a control operation that says, if the string is any of these, do something, and if it's any of the others, don't. And that's what you don't have in the Clifford subtheory, a way of going in and conditioning on precisely which, like on any arbitrary subset of strings, I can only condition in much more limited ways. Maybe not, but I'll think about what I can.
It's basically the same as the computation being linear.
It's the same as?
The computation being linear.
It's totally linear.
It's the same as the computation being linear.
Linear.
Yeah. So, like, you're looking for a function from bit strings to like 0 or 1.
Right.
And in the Clifford subtheory, you can only do linear functions.
Is that true? The Shane Mansfield paper gives a circuit that can compute a nonlinear function with the Clifford subtheory, which only has a classical.
But I think that paper is not the Clifford subtheory in the sense that it's not a motile version of Clifford subtheory.
You can consider the classical control to be just randomly measured some input state. Okay, generate a random bit to each of the operations.
Well, the question is, can you model it? Can I write down a Clifford circuit that emulates exactly what the control computer is doing?
I mean, you just need to be able to generate a bit, right, for each input. So a bit for A, a bit for B, and then classically control your second circuit by that outcome, which should be possible in the circuit or within the clip group.
That's probably the problem. I don't have any interest in control teams.
But those are only called quantum control, right? This is more like a classical control.
Well, I think in this Carmichael picture, you should be able to describe a classical control quantum.
Yeah, maybe a simple example would be, suppose I just want to get a 3/4, 1/4 coin toss. So what I do is I flip 2 of my coins, and I say, now I'm going to condition on them both being 1. How do I do that? Well, to do that, I need to evaluate the function, which is the AND of the two bits. Or if I think of the bits as plus or minus 1 valued, it's the product. And that is a nonlinear function. That is not something that I can build out of a Clifford circuit. And that's why that control operation doesn't exist. Yeah, the thing what I said wrong was that if you take it to be plus or minus 1, it's the product. It's, if you take it to be 0, 1 valued, it's the product of the bits.
Right, so for all sequences 0, 1, 1, 0, and 0, 0, the product is 0. For 1, 1, the product is 1.
But you just need to do binary addition to do that. So, well, if it changes paper, you just need to do a binary addition, right? All your inputs A and B. Your classical control computer just has to do binary addition, which is linear.
So right.
As long as you can generate those bits, you're still living within what I would say is a clipped computer out there.
Well, I don't remember the details of his circuit well enough.
Is it similar to the Amos Brown thing?
Yeah, it's supposed to be at least. Basically, you.
Because to think like, you definitely need control hardware, because you like, have to do X or Y measurements.
Yeah, like Anders Brown is doing exactly that. It's, you have a classical computer that can only do linear stuff.
Yeah.
And then you've got a resource of quantum correlations, like a GHZ state. And then by doing a kind of standard GHZ kind of experiment, I can, the whole thing will simulate nonlinear functions. But to do it, I need to be able to either measure X or Y on a given thing. And if I want to encode that in a Clifford circuit and say, right, this wire is going to have X or Y measured on it, conditional on this guy, I need a controlled Hadamard to switch between
so maybe
X and Y operations.
Controlled phases that in the chain circuit.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that the Mansfield-Sheffield paper probably requires something similar.
There's a distinction between doing a controlled phase gate on a quantum classical bit and doing a controlled phase in a quantum sense, right?
I can always model, if my control is a classical system, I can always model that as a quantum system where I'm controlling on, say, the computation basis. And that's what I'm doing. And like when I ask, is there a kind of motile version of the circuit, every classical wire in that circuit is going to be modeled by a quantum wire in my circuit, and things are just going to interact with it in this one basis alone.
I think you allow for like an even greater richness then, right? Because you've got, you can do things in that circuit which you couldn't do with just the classical circuit.
Sure.
And then you have to answer, why can't I do that? Why couldn't I do that with my classical computer? But now I've generalize some sort of quantum computer which effectively could perform the same circuit. But like I can't do that with my own.
I mean, that's not exactly the case. Because, so I think he's pointing out that if you coherentize a control K, a classically controlled K, into a quantumly controlled K, it would be a different input even to gain universality. But the point is, you have to be different. So, it's different. If you coherentize it, it's a different theory. It has different computational power, but the whole point is that the coherentized version is outside the theory, therefore it's not motile in that sense. That classical control computer is not in the motile version.
Maybe what it says that if you look at all the classically controlled operations that can be simulated in the Clifford sub-theory, right? And so suppose I give them to you as classical controls, then there's sort of no problem giving a quantum model of it. But if I said, let's take a Clifford theory and I add a classically controlled Hadamard, then I can't simulate, I can't replace that classical variable with a quantum system that's just being measured in the 0-1 basis. To add that to my Clifford circuit would be to add something that's outside the Clifford set, and we know that if I take any unitary outside the Clifford group and I close, I get all unitaries. So now I'm way outside.
Yeah.
If you want a more accurate quantum model of the classical control, you could put some decoherence on the control.
That's what
system, right? Yeah. You could do that in the same way.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You're still not going to get anything on control panels.
So, just as a kind of account head, if you're looking at constructing ontological models for motile theories, one of the think I thought about this a while ago. One of the problems you run against is if you want to actually make sure that the test is valid for everything that you've done in the formal theory, it ends up being correct for the classically controlled versions of things as well. When I was at least thinking that, so have you given any support to how you would actually construct a theory that is specifically correct only for things you can do and isn't correct for the classically controlled cases or the things that are not perfect?
I think this question might boil down to the following. If my conjectures were correct and the cut motile version of the Clifford subtheory does admit an architectural model, then I should be able to construct one explicitly.
Yeah.
But I don't have such a thing. So, Matt, you constructed with Terry years ago something that was supposed to be a kind of weak simulation of Clifford circuits, like taking into account extra bits of information. In my mind, that's the closest thing we have to a non-contextual model of a cut motile version of the Clifford theory. But I'm not convinced it really is that. It just seems like it's in the right space.
So just to clarify, if it works for n qubits, as a kind of, that I can, for also all kind of, everything that I can do in the FOIL theory for n qubits, and I add, then I can take two things that it works correctly for, and conditioned on a classical bit, I can put between them. And that's not cut motile. But the theory, by constructing it to work for n qubits, I've enabled it to work at the same time for a non-cut motile version.
I think the point of confusion might be that there's a difference between an operational theory allowing for like internal contextuality experiments and admitting of a non-contextual. So I think that it's probably the case that the qubit state of the theory, I mean, we know it doesn't have non-contextual models, and it's probably the case that, but it is also probably the case that it doesn't have contextuality experiments explicitly inside the theory.
So even the cut motile version doesn't have a non-contextual ontological model. Like, do you get my argument that you could just...
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems right.
Yeah.
So it seems like you can't have a non-contextual ontological model of the cut motile version of the qubit stabilizer theory. Even if it doesn't emit. That's weird.
Yeah, that's strange. So the idea is that it could be that the cut motile version of the Clifford subtheory does not allow any circuits which would yield experimental statistics that violate a non-contextuality inequality, and yet it also would not admit of any non-contextual models.
Yes.
So it would require, if I want to have an ontological model, it would have to be contextual, but there would be no operational signature of that, which is like contextuality at a meta level.
Yeah.
That's really bizarre.
John, can I just ask one last question? In the group with Hakob and Steve gave this model which you have like some sort of chaotic spaces that's trivial of like a L and Q, that
was in the paper with Hakob.
Oh, it wasn't. Okay. But you said it here. But that's...
I cited it because it's basically the same.
Okay. That would constitute a semantic model, right?
Yeah.
So it's...
Perhaps I didn't make this explicit enough. Part of the jarring turning point in my talk was transformation non-contextuality. If you want anything interesting, you can't. You just can't do it. Like, you just have nothing that you can do. Transformation non-contextuality is just as well motivated as preparation non-contextuality. So if I'm going to violate one, I may as well violate both. And So that's why I went from looking at its frames to just say, well, let's look at real space.
So, if there are no other urgent questions, we are now all leaving for this task. It is a test that we stop with. Thank you again for the talk.